everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lapide CISO Talks. Today we're joined by Charles Payne, the CISO at Neptune Media. Charles is a cybersecurity leader and investor with over 25 years of experience in all facets of cybersecurity. He's also one of the organizers of Horizon Summit, an event that brings together experts and professionals in the fields of AI, cybersecurity, and fintech. Charles, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Vitaly. It's always a pleasure to be here.
All good. Well, we're here to talk cybersecurity and about your expertise as a CISO. And I was having a look through your LinkedIn profile, and I saw that something that jumped out at me was your mission, which is to help organizations thrive in the face of the evolving cybersecurity threats and building unwavering trust with their stakeholders. Sort of given your background, what does this mission mean to you in practice as a CISO? Why is it so important, do you think?
The reason why it's so important is because the only way that we can actually accomplish anything is if we trust each other, which inherently cybersecurity professionals are typically more evasive to, only because it's in our nature, right? We're always, dealing with people phishing us or, being fished or whatever the case may be. So it's always one of those, I don't want to say this, but it's adversarial things where we're always expecting someone's trying to play a joke on us, for example. And that's, so my mission is more along the lines of trying to foster the next generation and try to build out what we really need to do. And I do that, again, by instilling trust with my board as well as with our peers and with my peers.
Yeah, that's great. You can certainly see that that drive towards empowering, the next generation of cybersecurity professionals through your events, and also, the tutoring and mentoring work that you do, which is fantastic to see. But you weren't always in cybersecurity, were you? There was a sort of a background in finance, I believe.
Yes. So actually, my background started in finance. I mean, I'm still in finance, don't get me wrong. But yes, I've been in finance actually longer than I've been in IT or technical services with computers and IT infrastructure, et cetera. So, or cybersecurity for that matter, before it was cybersecurity.
Okay. So you went from finance into cybersecurity. And what led you down that path? Was it kind of the technical expertise or just pure curiosity?
It was the curiosity. It was the question of, I'm one of those folks that like to take a challenge and I like to really learn. I don't want to do a challenge just for the sake of doing a challenge. I want to accomplish a challenge for the sake of actually learning and advancing my skills, to learn something new, just like anybody else. And I took what I did in finance and I applied a lot of that stuff to, IT infrastructure and information technology as we knew it back then. I mean, today we call it cybersecurity for what we do now, but I was able to take my business information, my business knowledge, and actually apply it to what I'm doing. I think that's the fundamental reason why I'm actually successful as a CISO is because I understand how to speak business to the stakeholders. And that's where a lot of the other CISOs don't have that same acumen. And that's where it becomes really complicated, where they don't get their budgets or they don't get the tools that they need because they don't know how to describe what they're really asking for in terms of dollars and cents that the board and the people who actually write their checks understand.
Yeah, it's always about, we hear this a lot about being able to communicate the kind of the technical aspect and merge that with the business side of things and the bottom line. And yeah, not everyone can communicate that. I suppose your previous experience and your background kind of lends itself very nicely where those two worlds collide. Is there any kind of advice you would give to those CISOs you mentioned, maybe don't have that acumen? How can they improve upon that?
There's actually I'm part of FAIR Institute. So it's, and again, I'm not saying that every different framework is the best for everything, but it gives you the fundamentals of what you need to do. And that's really what's important for the people who don't already know. Is the fundamentals are basically taking a risk and then being able to transpose that risk in terms of dollars and cents. So basically, you know, I've looked at the IBM reports many times, and I just find the IBM reports and their evaluations of how they assess what, you know, the potential risk is in terms of dollars and cents to be inaccurate in my case. I tend to lean more towards fair. I mean, people might have the inverse reaction, and it might be better for them for IBM reports versus fair, but fair gives you a baseline and gives you a metric of, like, if you have this breach, then it would equate with these type of assets to this type of financial risk. So it gives you a way to quantify and qualify risk in terms of dollars and cents, and then that's where you ask your board, do you accept this value of risk at these amount of dollars, because it would cost X amount of dollars to mitigate or to reduce. And that's really where the conversation is, and that's where really people struggle, because they don't understand that how to quantify or qualify the risk. Like, so for example, like if you go back to like an Equifax breach where, you know, they had their password admin, if they would have had a tool that, and again, everybody says that they can have anything that they want, but, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. But if you would have had a tool that would audit, for example, your infrastructure, that would tell you how much, you know, you were vulnerable because your passwords didn't meet a certain standard, it would give you a different risk qualification or a different metric. So essentially, you know, FAIR gives you the opportunities to assign values to risk metric, risk metrics.
I see. I think I heard that Forrester have a similar sort of risk assessment or ROI calculation report for various vendors. As a sales executive for Lapide, I typically go along the lines of, you know, what are your ICO fines likely to be? That's the Information Commissioner's Office. Were there to be a breach, you know, in the client's organization, you know, something like 4% of annual revenue, which, you know, far exceeds what you would actually pay for a solution. And it comes down to that kind of, you know, if something actually happens, almost like a form of insurance. But yeah, it's just a kind of an added layer of protection, meeting compliance. I'm sure you're well versed in that whole area of the kind of GRC, that governance, risk management, and compliance. Could you briefly touch on that? You know, what sort of strategies do you employ in your current role? And, you know, would you, you know, where would you start if, you know, maybe an immature IT team were trying to implement or improve upon their GRC?
So the fundamental purpose of GRC, it's the governance, risk, and compliance. So to qualify and to really define what that means, it's the governance. So you'll have like oversight from, you know, regulatory agencies. The risk is the fear of the value or the cost of exposure if it was breached or compromised, etc. And then the compliance is really just conforming to the standards. So to summarize that, when you look at a policy, if you were a new, my focus is I always look at, I advise a lot of startups, as you probably know from my profile and from other conversations. We do a lot of investing, and I talk to a lot of startups, you know, on a daily basis. Typically, a lot of startups focus on like a CEO or even a CTO because they focus on the building of technology and stuff like that. But they never really focus on the security part of it. And it's been a few times where I've seen, you know, brilliant startups, but actually lose their vision, lose their way because they were compromised. They weren't a security first culture. I think that's fundamentally where you need to start. When you have a CTO, make sure that they're focused on or have some type of technical acumen for the security side of it, not just trying to develop their solution fast into market, because it won't pay off in the end, or it potentially could cause you everything in the end. So going back to what I was saying for the initial, for example, startup, you want to make sure that whatever your product does, you conform to whatever standard you need to. So if you're doing like a cloud services, you'd have to have like FedRAMP, for example, if you wanted to sell to the government, you know, that in the United States. So that would be the GRC aspect of that would be trying to make sure that you go through all the policies and procedures of how to actually apply for FedRAMP and actually start that process. And then what you need to do to stay compliant and all the regulatory requirements after that. Now, granted, FedRAMP costs, you know, a minimum of $100,000, so it's definitely not for, like, you know, day one startup. I'm talking about, like, as they're starting to progress, but its whole purpose is to build out some type of uniform standard. Even if we look at PCI, which is for the payment card industry, they want you to make sure that you have the basic rudimentary protections for protecting the credit card data. And the funny part about it is at the end of the day, you know, Visa, MasterCard, they don't really mind too much if you're the one that caused the breach, as long as you can afford to pay for it. Because in your terms and conditions of your merchant agreement, you're responsible for paying for all the cards that were compromised. So as a card member, you don't have any, you have a zero liability for fraud. The flip side is whoever caused the breach or whoever caused that issue to occur because they were negligent or what have you, they're actually responsible for paying for all those charges. So that's where Visa, MasterCard kind of, you know, shifts the blame to or shifts responsibility, correction. So that, I don't know if that's very a valid answer to your question, but it's always trying to start with what are your goals and objectives, and then trying to build out the policies and make sure that you're compliant to whatever regulatory compliances that you need to be. In my case, we touch credit card information, so we have to make sure that we protect that. Otherwise, we're responsible for any of the compromised data or compromised cards. And that's where I guess it becomes a little bit, I don't know if that answers your question enough, though.
Yeah, no, it certainly does. I mean, I'm kind of just expanding on it a little bit, but I'd say, you know, Lapide gets into that space quite a bit with the data discovery and classification side of our solution, you know, locating that PII and PCI and GDPR data and classifying it based on, you know, those compliances. You know, that's part of the journey, just understanding how much of that data you have. Again, it falls under all those various frameworks and guidelines for cyber essentials and ISO 27001s. Just to kind of change gears a little bit, I'm curious to touch on your sort of investment strategy. I know you're an angel investor and you're clearly very active in that world. What is your sort of criteria for, you know, selecting a viable investment, as it were? And, you know, what do you typically look for?
So my most famous question probably is I'll ask every startup or every person who's pitching, how much does it cost them for customer acquisition? Because that's something that's most commonly always overlooked. They never focus on how much it actually costs to get a customer. They always think about, if I get one customer, I can get X amount of dollars. Great. But if it costs you, you know, 3X of the amount of dollars that you received, it's probably not a viable business. And that's actually been the case for a few times where it might cost, I've had a couple of businesses tell me it costs them about $40,000 to $50,000 for customer acquisition. You know, in the first year, they'll make about $20,000 to $30,000. So the only time that they'll actually make money is if the customer renews. And that customer churn is always a problem because you're always going to have customer churn. So the question is, do you really pay the customer to be your customer at that point in time on the hope or the premise that they're actually going to renew long term? And that's where things get a little bit crazy. So my biggest thing is always to know how much it costs for customer acquisition, because I never trust the numbers that I'm given. I always trust the information that I can drive myself. And part of that metric when they're actually giving me their information is if they don't know how much it costs them to acquire a customer, they don't really know how to give me a business plan that's properly suited for what they're asking for, because they don't know if they're asking for too much money or too little money. And 9 times out of 10, they're asking for too little. So the question then becomes, okay, so if you get X amount of dollars from me, how many more of me's do you need to actually get to where you need to go to be successful? Because the last thing I want to do is put in $1 million or so, but you really needed $100 million or $10 million to get where you needed to go. So unless I can find, you know, 9 more people to come in, you know, I lost my $1 million.
So it sounds like you probably steer away from the type of startups that have a loss leading strategy, like your Ubers and so on, where, you know, the customer acquisition is, yeah, loss leading. Basically, they're paying people basically to be customers, as I understand it.
You know, a loss leading strategy has a form and function. So I won't disagree with those type of strategies. I mean, that's what in America we have, like Black Friday, so the day after Thanksgiving, and that's always a loss leader for getting people into the store to drive traffic and those impulse buys, because Americans typically or inherently are impulsive. So if you put something next to something that's, you know, on sale, but you put a higher profitable item, the probability of them buying both items is pretty high. So that's where, you know, I looked at some of the stuff that, you know, even Walmart does. and how they do their strategies and how they focus on, you know, the psychology behind shopping. And I did that just as a sequential thing for something else, but it really became eye-opening about how they actually do the strategies and why they put things where they do and how they do it. So I thought it was pretty interesting. So I don't have a problem on a loss leading strategy from an investment perspective, as long as I'm not the only investor, because then I have to, you know, I have to front 100% of everything. That's always painful. So I like to diversify and split and obviously do the same thing that they're looking for. I'm looking for unity in the community. So I'll look for other investors to make sure that we can all diversify the risk across our portfolios. So just because they have a loss leading strategy initially doesn't mean that it's bad. It just means that I already know up front that I can't be the only one that comes in, because then I won't have the ability to focus enough time or focus enough energy on it. I need to bring in additional support to make sure that, you know, if I'm not looking at it, the other investment firm's looking at it, or vice versa. So we have some type of, you know, accountability and uniformity across the portfolio or across that one individual investment.
I see. And in terms of, you know, the types of technologies and the types of businesses that you're kind of interested by or intrigued by, again, that kind of curiosity piece, is there anything kind of hot and trending at the moment? Would you say that you think, okay, yeah, that's kind of where things are heading, and maybe also kind of mixing in with the cybersecurity world?
Yes, I mean, so I see a lot of stuff in AI, but I know that when I was talking with the vice president of Microsoft, and in fact, he wasn't being arrogant about it, but he's like, we've already, as a result of all the stuff that we're doing at Microsoft, we've already caused at least 1,000 startups that were already there to be obsolete. So all those startups that had all that investment capital behind them were just wiped out in a matter of months by the way that Microsoft was so innovative, and they're pushing for everything that they were doing. So it's like, I took what he said. I thought about it for a moment. I'm like, okay, objectively, he's trying to tell me something without trying to tell me something. He's trying to say, like, look, if you buy stuff in cybersecurity, specifically towards AI, he's like, the probability of Microsoft duplicating or copying what you're doing is, especially if it's a great idea, is pretty high. And if we do, or if Microsoft does, have no fear that the billion-dollar giants is here, and they'll basically give it away for free or do whatever they're going to do, and it'll make whatever you're doing obsolete. I mean, compare Midjourney, what you have for graphics, and then just think about Microsoft has their graphics search engine. And now you don't have to subscribe to it. It comes free. So if you want Copilot to go create your graphic, you just tell it what it wants, and it does it. And it actually does it with phenomenal accuracy. And it's actually rather amazing. I was playing with it the other day again, just trying to play with, you know, our podcast logos. I mean, look at our backgrounds. I'm like, it's just crazy. I'm just playing to see what happens. And it's the ability that it has to create stuff is phenomenal. And granted, you know, Midjourney and some of the other softwares are great too. But the difference between those and Microsoft is Microsoft has the same capabilities and features they do, plus a couple others, and it's free. You don't have to subscribe to the services and do everything else. So it's like, at the end of the day, you know, what you see there, so Midjourney did all this development and stuff, and then Microsoft came in and said, yeah, I like that. We're going to do it too. And do you want to go with Microsoft? Do you want to go to another third-party app that you have to subscribe to? Well, I'm already part of Microsoft. It's already free for me. I'm just going to use it. It's free. Why buy a third-party subscription? And that was kind of like what I'm seeing in the consolidation part of the market. So you've got the bigger companies starting to consolidate what all of the other different genres are, or industries are, or categories, etc. And that's where I tend to get a little bit more skittish.
Is there not much acquisition taking place in that, or is it because it's not? Is it patentable? Like some of the AI technologies that, you know, I guess it depends how innovative they are, or is it just everything's kind of open and you can duplicate I'm not quite sure how it works really, because I suppose in Silicon Valley, you know, when new startups get started, they I guess their exit strategy is always to get bought by a Google or a Facebook or Meta or you know, a Microsoft, isn't it?
It is. I mean, a software business is really difficult because you can't patent your software unless you divulge your code. You have to divulge every line of your code. And I actually had that same discussion with our internal group, and they're like, you know, if you do that, you have to divulge your code out. I'm like, oh, okay, never mind. So, but I mean, you can copyright it and stuff like that. But in terms of actually protecting the intellectual property with a patent, so there's nobody else could duplicate it, is not feasible. Right. Possible, not feasible, because you'd have to release, you know, every bit of your code, and that's kind of where I think ChatGPT and OpenAI right now is being sued for their model. They were initially public and then they went private. I think they're trying to say, well, how could you technically go private after you're going public because you built it off of publicly accessible stuff, which you can't privatize.
After you were open source, you tried to monetize everything, right?
So that's I'm waiting to see what happens with that lawsuit. That's gonna be interesting for me. I'll be curious for that. But in the industry itself, you know, as a CISO or CIO or CTO, we don't stop spending money. We didn't stop spending money. We just stopped spending this stuff. We stopped buying the shiny objects. We finally started to catch up and get educated enough to the point where, hey, look, you know, we have some liability and responsibility here to one of our shareholders and stakeholders, but also to the government if we get breached and something happens. So maybe we should start paying more attention about what we're doing and how we're doing it, as opposed to just buying everything that's new and saying that we're trying. Maybe it's time to start doing instead of always consistently trying. And I think that was a shift that we saw last year and that's following through this year. It's not that cybersecurity professionals aren't spending money. The sky's not falling. But what is happening is we're not buying the next shiny thing because we have some liability now. You've seen all the lawsuits in the past and people be charged criminally, and I don't want to mention all the names and stuff, but you're starting to see this in the United States, where if you are a CISO, or not, I haven't seen it for the CIO, but if you're a CISO, for example, and you made a bad decision, you technically be held criminally responsible for those bad decisions. And I think that's where the market holistically is looking at, like, oh, okay, well, I don't want to be like that last guy, so what can I do to make sure I'm not like him? And it's like, well, let me go try to buy something that's tried and true, as opposed to trying to buy something that's new, because I don't want to be the experiment. I think that's what we're seeing at the moment. I think that's been the conversation that I've had, at least with my peers, for the moment. That's how we're looking at things, especially in financial services. We're tending to focus more along the lines of the stuff that's tried and true, that we know is not going to have an issue down the line, as opposed to something that might be new and innovative that you don't know. So we're trying to find something that's got a track record.
Yeah, maybe where the lines are slightly blurred on the legality side of things. That was actually going to be one of my other questions around, you know, the legal responsibilities of corporate executives, you know, your CISOs and so on. So, but it is all over the news and some high profile cases, which kind of is pretty scary for anyone in a CISO role. if you don't have that kind of, call it like a limited liability, as it were, you know, detachment from the entity. But there we go. I suppose you're having quite a lot of these high level conversations with attendees of the Horizon Summit.
We do. We actually focus on those as well. That it's always a valid conversation that we have with peers, because it's something that. It's a responsibility that we have to have, one with our community and with our shareholders, stakeholders, etc. But at the same token, nobody wants to be like the last guy that went to jail or that got charged for whatever and had to spend millions of dollars for defense. Nobody wants to be the last guy. And definitely nobody wants to be the next guy. So that's where we have to be vigilant what we're doing and mindful. I think that's what we do talk about, yes. Yeah, we're going to start doing some more one-day summits as well. And we're going to start, we've got an office in New York that we'll be doing some stuff at. We'll be doing some things in Dallas and probably California and stuff, where there's also other investment groups that we're part of. So we're going to start trying to bring what we're doing now at large scale to a lot of the smaller one-day events. I think that's probably our most exciting news, is we've done so many things on a large scale, but they're catered more towards everybody at the top, that we're trying to bring all of that great information, all of those experiences down to everybody else throughout the entire life cycle or through the entire pipeline of the community. And that's what we're actually working on next. That's our next big thing. And we're going to be running that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add that you seem to be really passionate about the whole, you know, community engagement and, you know, public speaking, bringing together, you know, people face-to-face in a room, exchanging ideas, but also kind of seeing where the exciting new things are coming from. It's great to hear that you're going to do single day events. I would certainly love a ticket to the Hawaii event, but it's a bit of a long trip from the UK, to be honest.
It is, and I agree with that. We're actually going to probably focus our Hawaii trip just on our exclusive base that we have for some. I forgot what one of our partners called it, but it's an experience. So they actually we have an experience excursion. I think that's what we're gonna leave Hawaii as, like, strictly like an experience based project, and then we're gonna try to wrap what we learned from that each session into all of our summits that we're doing throughout the year in all of the individual states around the United States anyway. So I know that
Sorry again to interrupt, but what do you think is the real value in, you know, bringing people together in this way? Because I know you, when we previously met, you said, you know, just having those kind of face-to-face conversations with the right people in the room makes such a difference. But, you know, can you elaborate on that?
Yes. So essentially what happens when you're face-to-face is you can have a candid conversation with each other. Like, I've been in financial services, obviously, for too long. So the regulations, going back to GRC, you can't have a candid conversation with somebody over the phone or over Zoom, because if they're recording it and someone gets to the, you know, it's one of those problems. So you can't really have an honest, direct, candid conversation with a peer over the phone or on a Zoom meeting, for example. You have to do it in person, because there are certain things that you can't talk about publicly. There's certain things that you can't say that could potentially be recorded. And that's where you have to have that personal one-on-one connection or face-to-face meeting with people in a boardroom setting. And that's where the advantage comes in. It's because you can have those candid, real conversations without fear of knowing that something's going to leak out. So basically, like, chowder house rules, if you will, for those type of meetings. And I think that's where the advantage is, because at that point in time, you can have those candid conversations. You can talk about what's really going on in your environment without fear of, like, oh, maybe I'll get fired or lose my job, or maybe I broke a compliance because I said X, Y, and Z, and I wasn't supposed to say that yet. And especially if they recorded it, then it becomes public, and it's a problem. But it's not anything that we should be, you know, scared about per se. But at the same token, the only difference between, you know, a cybersecurity professional on the white team versus cybersecurity, or like white hat versus black hat type of scenario. So basically, like, think about hackers versus criminals. So hackers are not the bad people. Hackers are basically people that we hire on our team that we do for our own internal red teaming. You know, the criminals are the ones that go one step further and then use that exploitable function or fashion for, like, ransomware or whatnot. And those are the criminals. They're not the hackers. They're two different delineated groups. And that's where, I want to draw the line for. But the hackers are, you know, where I want to go back with that is the bottom line is, in order for us to be successful in what we're doing, we have to communicate. The hackers inside of our own teams will communicate, our red teams will communicate with each other, but we'll never real time communicate with the outside world. And when I go back, and let me step back, when we're internal, we keep everything that we're doing inside our own company's walls. So if we have an incident, or we have a breach, or we have, you know, something, we see some type of IOCs or TTPs or whatever, so, you know, indicators are compromised, for example, we don't share that openly with the world or with the community instantaneously. There's no real-time update for that. And that's where we suffer as a community. Because if I'm getting attacked, the probability of my friends or my other colleagues or peers being attacked in the same financial services industry is pretty high. If they're targeting me, they're probably targeting them. Maybe they know it yet, maybe they don't, and that's the problem. So going back to that is, we don't openly disclose what's going on in real time in our environments. Whereas if you're a criminal, you're actively talking back and forth between your own internal community. Hey, look, this firewall's got a vulnerability. Here's how you exploit it. But I can't figure out how to get to the next step. And they'll actually work with themselves as an international community to get to the next step. And we're defending ourselves individually as an isolated company. And we're never going to win with this strategy. It's always a losing battle, because when you're trying to break in, it only takes one. But when you're trying to defend, it takes everybody. It takes 100%. You have to be 100% flawless on the blue team, but the red team side only needs to be flawless 1% of the time, and that's where the adversarial part comes in. on the internal side of our companies, we're siloed, but the rest of the world on the criminal side, they're not. They're talking to everybody and anybody. And that's where the real problem becomes. And that's why I focus, going back to your question earlier and point earlier, that's why I focus so heavily on community. Because if you don't have that community support, you don't have that community connection, you're kind of SOL. I mean, in short of saying it, I mean, like, there are other ISACs that do, you know, TTPs and IOCs, indicators of compromise and stuff. But the problem is, even though we share information like that in the past or currently or future, it's not real time. It's still going to be sanitized. It's still going to be delayed. There's still going to be a problem. There's still going to be some type of latency behind it. And it might be a week. It might be a month. It might be, you know, a little bit more or less than that. But at that point in time, if I would have told you in real time, you potentially could have already known. You could have already protected yourself, and you would have been okay. Because the criminals are going to share the data in real time. But, you know, on our side, we don't. And that's the fundamental problem of why we have a problem in our community. And that's why I just keep driving that advocacy.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to the point at the start where, you know, CISOs are quite careful, quite paranoid, as it were, and they don't perhaps want to share things, especially if they, you know, were nearly breached or did suffer a breach. You know, it's typically kind of hush-hush rather than saying, okay, what can we learn from this or within the community, and saying, you know, again, you know, if attackers are going for a particular sector, they're going to look for similar vulnerabilities in similar types of companies, aren't they? Perhaps just maybe a parting question, going back to sort of, you know, your mentoring and speaking and teaching. How do you approach mentoring, advising aspiring cybersecurity professionals, and what would you advise the next generation, as it were?
So I currently mentoring right now through Cyversity and a couple others, but I always, the most important thing to do is not chase the money aspect of the cybersecurity part. The money comes, you know, later on. Sometimes it will come initially, and sometimes it won't. It's really going to depend on what your passion is. So I always tell people, even the people that I'm mentoring, the first question I ask them is, like, after we get through all the pleasantries, is like, what do you like to do? Tell me about, like, what are your hobbies? Tell me about a little bit more about your experiences. Tell me about what you find fun and interesting. And I'll try to relate that and understand, like, okay, do you like mysteries? Do you like solving, you know, questions or puzzles? To, like, maybe you like digital forensics. Maybe you like some type of other type of, you know, SOC analyst, like a SOC analyst or some type of other position like that. But it's where I need to understand fundamentally what the person likes to do, so I can match them with what they might be best suited for. And it's not something that they're going to be doing long term. So I try to walk all the people through that I mentor, typically once I understand what their goals and objectives are, to put them on the path that they can get to management, that they can oversee a team. Because at one point in time, you know, when you're young, it's great to be the analyst. It's great to, you know, have eyes on glass. But as you get older, you tend to have to make sure that you advance. And the easiest way to do that is to step into management. But you can also still be very technical, like a CTO, a CIO, a CISO. We're technical. Not all of us, but a lot of us are. And we understand that the normal GRCs and the risks and the governance and everything else that goes along with it. So having the technical acumen mixed with the business acumen is very important. It's not necessary. It's not a requirement, but it gives you a different perspective that most folks don't have. And that's, I think, what makes me unique, is I have technical skills, but I also have the business acumen that goes along with it. So it's different. I can understand and explain to both sides of the house or the organization, whereas most either have one or the other, but they don't typically have both.
That's great. Yeah, I suppose we've come full circle there, and just kind of, again, highlighting the need for just constantly learning, improving those skills, but also focusing on, you know, highlighting your strengths and playing to those rather than trying to kind of improve upon your weaknesses. But, you know, just, yeah, like you said, you know, find out what inspires you, what drives your curiosity, lean into that, and yeah, play to your strengths, and that should at least keep the work more compelling as you progress through your career.
Absolutely. In fact, I was talking with another executive the other day. Our company does a lot of M&As, and so mergers and acquisitions. And it was one of those things in cybersecurity, you know, we always try to bring up to whatever the company we just acquired, we bring up their standards, their cybersecurity standards to our standards. So we always try to elevate the current company that we purchased or we acquired to whatever our current cybersecurity standards are. And the funny part wasn't so much about that as a CISO. It was about as a CEO, someone asked me, how do you actually transition, or how do you actually work with other folks that you acquired, or how do you actually bring people to the same level or the same standards that you guys are? And it was one of those things where we actually had an interesting conversation. It wasn't about so much trying to change everybody in the very beginning and trying to say like, oh no, you guys can't do your cybersecurity posture this way because it's the wrong way to do it. It's more along the lines of starting out first time what they did correct the first time. So start everything off with positivity. So like, okay, you guys are doing this great. You guys are doing this really well. And start talking to them about and auditing all the stuff that they're doing really well first. And then after you get through all of the pleasantries there, then at that point in time, go back after and then start realizing what they need to improve on. But you don't want to lead, at least initially, with a negative foot. You don't want to start a negative initially, because then you've got a bad connotation and that relationship's never going to foster and grow. So the easiest way to foster and grow the relationship, and this is actually a lesson I learned. I learned it the hard way, granted, and it was a conversation that another executive told me. He's like, look, never lead with negativity. Never be the guy with the glass that's half empty. Always be the guy with the glass half full. He's like, lead with that, and everybody else will tend to be happier. If you always lead with negativity and criticism, you're never going to get anybody else on board. You're never going to get buy-in if everyone's always trying to be defensive.
Yeah, like the feedback sandwich where you go with a positive and then you put the negative in the middle and then you finish with a positive again.
Yes, it's exactly like that.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, very nice point to end on, I think. And I think we can wrap it up there.